This is a CNA podcast.
I'm Lin Su Ling, and welcome to Heart of the Matter, where we take a hard look each week at some of the biggest news stories. Keto, vegan, flexitarian, low carb, no carb, and intermittent fasting. If you want to shed some weight, change your relationship with food, or just get healthier, you're spoiled for choices. Now, a CNA Insider story this week dive deep with my colleague Steve Chia's experiment with intermittent fasting, which got a lot of attention. But do these diets really work? Can they bring a host of new problems less talked about? And what role does our culture play in our wellness, in the foods we eat, in the diseases we might even inherit? There's a lot on our plate today, so let's just get to it. It's Thursday, March 11, and with me to discuss these issues and more are Jacqueline Reuters, founder of Aptima Nutrition.
Hi.
And Assistant Professor Asim Shabir, Director at the Centre for Obesity Management and Surgery at the National University Hospital.
Hi.
Hi, guys. So just get into it, right? What makes intermittent fasting so attractive than, say, just a simple rule of cutting sugars, fats, oil, or even meat from your diet, or even counting calories? What's your take, Jacqueline?
So I think why this diet gained popularity is because it's a diet that doesn't tell you you can't eat sweets and deep fried food. It's like everyone knows that. It's obvious. But when someone says you can eat anything that you want within 8 hours, hey, I think I can do it. Instead of hearing you can't eat that, it's like eat whatever you want, but within a certain period of time. So it makes it a lot easier to follow.
Is that your take as well?
Yeah, so I would agree with Jacqueline on the premises of the choices of meals to make. But she makes an important point that you would also agree is this is sort of regimenting somebody to trying to recreate the lost discipline that that person might have had.
Oh dear.
All right, so it's really about taking the person accountable for and disciplining the patient back on that route is what it is all about. But a bit more freedom in choices that patients make. So yeah, I would agree on that.
So let's just get into the benefits first. There's been a lot of talk about what it helps you do. You're sharper, you lose more weight, maybe you're healthier, your liver reacts differently, your brain reacts differently. But how much of these claims have been overstated? Because of course, a lot of the studies that sparked intermittent fasting were found in rats.
So I think why people feel a lot better is because, and I do have a lot of patients who have tried intermittent fasting and they have reported, you know, feeling much better. And I tell them it's because when you start on a diet, you try to be also as healthy as you can. So there are some people who, when they start this 8-hour eating, they tend to eat a bit more fruits, a lot of vegetables. They take out all that junk foods that they used to eat before. And you naturally feel better because you're putting more good stuff into your body. Nothing really magical happens between the 16 and 18 hours that makes you feel a lot better. It's just the quality of food that is probably better when you start this diet. The benefits are true. But I've also had people who have done this and saw no weight loss at all. They still feel exactly the same as because during the 8 hours. So they take the 8 hours and they apply the different principles to it. Oh, I can eat anything. Okay, I'll have fast food for my first meal and then I'll just eat ice cream middle of the day and something else just before 8 o'clock. So if your quality of the foods aren't good, I don't think you're going to feel a lot better. So it still boils down to your food choices.
It really sounds like it's about individual choices and it might change from individual to individual as well, even if you control what you eat. Asim, what does the studies tell us about what the effects are across the population though? Because anecdotally, of course, some people might say they feel better. But what are the health benefits?
First of all, we need to understand that fasting is not something that is new to mankind. It's been probably the longest known intervention we've ever known that mankind has done, or evolutionarily, it's been always been there. That's number one. The second thing is that if you look at fasting, we all fast. For a traditional home, if you look at it, you have your meals about 7:30 in the evening. How many people have a supper? Maybe another 10-20% of people. Beyond that, all eating habits are abnormal. Those grazing at night, doing night duties and eating, these are abnormal, not natural outcomes, right? Most people would wake up about 6:30, have their breakfast at 7, and that's a good 12 hours of fasting. So you would agree that most of us do fast across the night, and that's, if we keep to it, that's just great in its own self.
Are you saying actually that a lot of benefits arise because of, number one, control of your diet, and number two, weight loss, rather than something magical behind intermittent fasting?
In general, any dieting program that you would join which will result in weight loss will give you these benefits. habits, right? So the physiology behind it is that your energy supplies kind of deplete. You use up the extra calories that you've had accumulated over the daytime to replenish whatever is going on in the middle of the night to rebuild you, and you use those blocks. So what happens is, as a result of it, your sugar levels trend down to normal. The body basically takes care of all the extra sugar, and then you're ready for the next day. This is exactly what it does. It basically decreases insulin resistance. When you lose those extra pounds, gives you that real good self-esteem, gives you that real positive thinking in your brain about it. And that's great because you feel great. And yes, any fasting will have its impact on health.
Yeah. I just want to press the point a little bit more because there seems to be this suggestion that it makes you sharper and more focused when your body is hungry. But yet a lot of people who are on weight management programs say they find it a struggle to get through the day though, no?
Well, it depends what they're eating. If you go on a very low calorie diet and you're too depleted, then you don't put in enough food, of course you don't think as well. Why people also feel better on this diet is because perhaps in the morning when they used to eat the char kway teows in the morning, like very high fatty foods, but now they've taken that, of course you eat too much fat, it makes you sluggish. So if they've taken out breakfast, because normally people don't start eating till 12 o'clock, so they typically skip breakfast, so they've taken out all that high fat, high salt food, then of course you feel better because nothing makes you sluggish in the morning. So I think that's the reason why they feel a lot better.
I want to get a sense of whether indeed intermittent fasting is something that gets your stamp of approval as healthcare experts in this area. Don't you think that it's also a way, as a quick fix, a bandage over our inactive lives sitting around the office, that instead of intermittent fasting, perhaps we should also relook our lifestyles?
Yes, I would certainly agree to that. Intermittent fasting or going back to normal life is part of a natural program. Intermittent fasting should be actually a part of a normal routine. Life. It's just that there are very attritions of it, but the normal life is the best attrition, best kind of the one that I see. I mean, how does it really differ from what we've just talked about is the very important fact that when you are on intermittent fasting, you're consuming normal ingredients in food, right? Whereas if you're on other kinds of diet, which are likely lipogenic, that they're going to actually result in a lot of lipids being produced, fats being discharged, that extra amount of fat results in ketones, which suppresses the brain and gives you lethargy. But if you're able to replenish your normal sources of energy in the form of glucose and its product, then you remain active. But your amount...
So it depends on what you eat.
It depends partly on a combination of what you eat, not entirely what you eat.
Is that your sense as well, Jacqueline?
People asking me, can I do intermittent fasting? I tell them this. Well, first of all, I don't like this particular kind of dieting because I don't see why we should cram our three meals into 8 hours a day. However, if they're very insistent on it, I'll say, okay, here's my guide. Within those 8 hours, make sure that you get at least two very well-balanced meals, meaning that, you know, the first meal, make sure you get some low glycemic index carbohydrates with a lean protein and some vegetables. And then middle of the afternoon, 2-3 hours later, a small little snack. It could be like a yogurt or some fruit. And then the last meal of the day, very similar to what you had in the first meal of the day. So making sure that you have a balance, like within those 8 meals, is fine. But I tell them that if you're going to eat rubbish and junk food for those 8 hours, then it's not going to work for you. So I still try and steer them towards making more wholesome, healthier food choices. So after they've done it, then I'll say, okay, instead of 16-8 hours, because that's the most popular, I'll tend to stretch it, you know, maybe do like a 14-10.
So I hear you both saying that intermittent fasting shouldn't be a way to legitimize eating poorly, that basically, even though you keep to a certain time period, you really do need to pay attention to also what you're eating, and that you shouldn't let it then play into this culture of idolizing food. I ask because one of the reasons why Steve Chair also went into intermittent fasting was because he loves bubble tea. I guess I'm hearing you guys say that that shouldn't be licensed to drink more bubble tea.
It shouldn't definitely be the license to drink more bubble tea. But you see, these are small pleasures of life that you can't take away totally. So once in a while, having a bubble tea is okay. Once in a while, having an indulgence is okay. But indulgence cannot be a daily affair.
I agree with that completely. Yeah.
On the flip side, though, of course, a lot of careful attention must be paid to the messaging of this, because surely there's also a line between intermittent fasting and being mindful and keeping to a certain diet versus eating disorders and not wanting to also legitimize that, right?
You're absolutely right. So you can't say that, as we just discussed, 8 hours, I'm going to eat all the junk I have, and then the 16 hours I will fast. It's not going to work, number one. And even if it works, this is not creating something which is healthy for the rest of your life. And how long can you go on with that intermittent fasting is then the next biggest question. Can you keep up with all that kind of stuff for the rest of your life? The answer is very unlikely.
Yeah, very unlikely.
0.0001% of
really?
Patients.
But I thought intermittent fasting is one of those diets that most people can hurt to compared to the other diets, of course.
Well, as compared to other diets, probably, because no one's telling them you can't eat this, can't eat that. So it sounds nice, right? But then, you know, it's not for long term. I've had someone who has been intermittent fasting for 3 years. He did really well. And then after a while, he said, I can't do it. So I lengthened his fasting. And now he's back to a normal day, 12 hours of eating. And then that's what we probably do anyway. So it's not feasible for the long term. But, you know, as Asim said, in the beginning, if you need some sense of discipline initially to kickstart your health regime, then yeah, maybe, but it's not for the long term. It's really short term, but you still need to relook at what you're eating at the end of the day and the meal timings as well.
I just want to press the point a little bit more because some people have said that intermittent fasting is this fad that's gaining a lot of traction because we have really incredibly busy lives and a lot of us tend to skip meals. And some people say there might be worries that intermittent fasting might actually legitimize that kind of eating habits, which might not be too healthy for you. What do you say to that?
Normally, human beings run on a circadian rhythm, right? Which runs with the day and light cycle. Tagged to the circadian rhythms are hormone cycles as well, right? And tagged to those hormone cycles are GI hormones that are secreted when we eat, and they all play a central role in one big piece, right? So when you disrupt a normal nature cycle by doing these activities, you're creating a new artificial imbalance, which may play to your benefit for a while, but in the long term, it will not play to your benefit because it will change behavior, change the way the hormones coordinate with each other, and change other stuff in your body, which thus again makes it unsustainable.
So you're saying that if I keep to my intermittent fasting, I might actually see less benefits over the long term?
You may see less benefits. You may not see benefit. Again, it depends upon how you time your intermittent fasting. So if you time it as with the circadian rhythm, you make sure you don't eat at night, and during the day, you start early and end early as well, your meal, then you'll play to the tone of your body. But if you say, okay, I'm going to wake up at 11 o'clock and start my day at 11 o'clock with the breakfast, and I'm going to finish at 12 o'clock midnight, you're not playing to the tune of your body. And that's not good because you're way off your circadian rhythm and hormone cycles that you're having. And so you won't be able to keep it up.
So your body will actually push back against it?
The body is naturally designed to do that. See, through the process of evolution, where man has gone through periods of starvation, putting on fat is a natural way of saving us from starvation. So the body has always in its brain kept a set point that helps us maintain energy balance. And a quantum of fat will always be there. So if you don't have that, then you're in trouble. We don't have the other mechanism that if you're getting too fat, the body will stop you from becoming...
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that actually, yeah? Because I think obesity is a greater problem today, you know?
Yeah. We might, in the coming thousands of years of our evolution, develop that. But so far, man's biggest challenge has been starvation.
Oh, dear. I just want to ask you both also on this idea that for the longest time we've grown up with this age-old advice that breakfast is the most important meal of the day, you cannot skip that, and you should eat more often but maybe in smaller portions as well. Doesn't intermittent fasting go against that conventional wisdom, or has the conventional wisdom been proven wrong with science?
I personally do believe that breakfast is very important, but I tell people that breakfast is defined as eating within the first hour that you wake up. It doesn't matter what time you wake up. You can wake up at 6, eat before 7, you wake up at 11, eat before 12. As long as you eat within the first hour to tell your body that you're feeding yourself something so that your body can start burning calories. If you deprive yourself of calories initially, your body can go into like a mild starvation mode, meaning that it tends to hold on to the fat stores and it actually conserves energy instead of burning calories. And plus, breakfast has very important benefits too. It keeps your mind, it makes you more alert, it gives you energy. If you're eating 3 balanced meals a day, you know, you should be needing breakfast. Now, going to the point of eating 6 small meals a day to, you know, keep yourself healthy, I find that 6 small meals can be quite challenging because what is a small meal? It's relative. Your small meal can be my large meal. Like, is a curry puff a small meal? Is a sandwich a small meal or a main meal? It's very hard to define what is a small meal. And I generally like to tell people to eat 3 meals a day plus one snack if really needed. To make it more feasible, it's more sustainable. It's very practical. Because if you're eating every 2 or 3 hours, if you're so busy doing work, how are you going to just try and find a small meal just because you're trying to fit into the 6 small meals to be healthier?
If you look at traditionally, if you eat your dinner, say about 7, 7:30, and by the time you eat your next meal, which may be 6 o'clock in the morning, you've actually used up all the stored sugar in your liver.
Mm.
Right? So you have basically, if you're a normal individual, you have used up all your reserves that were available for you immediately, and you have to replenish them. That's why breakfast is the most important meal of the day. So you can replenish those stores, so your life goes on nicely, right? As you go through the day, the calorie intake should be reduced, so your dinner should be technically your lightest meal. What have we done? We've made breakfast the lightest meal and the dinner the heaviest meal. After dinner, we don't do any exercise, we don't go strolling, nothing around. You sleep with it. All that we eat, apart from replenishing, then goes into a storage capacity and is not used towards the entire day's meal. So that's why breakfast is number one, very important part of our meal. As far as 3 meals are concerned, if you take a breakfast, which an average person takes is 8 o'clock in Singapore, lunch is 12 o'clock, there's hardly 4 hours in between 2 meals. If you pack a snack, by the time your glucose is going down at 2 hours time, you have peaked another spike by taking a snack.
Mm.
So by the time you hit lunch, you've barely cleared what you had from breakfast and you're in for another hit. So your body is in this constant fight to dispose your glucose. Sticking to 3 meals a day, with breakfast being the best of the choices, and moving along the day till the end of evening. And the occasional snack may be something that you could, but shouldn't be habitual in nature, you know. Unless, obviously, you eat salads for your breakfast, which again, you should be a portion, but it should be a balanced diet. You should have proteins on it, you should have carbs. But if you're someone who just eats salad, that snack may be something you may want to look at for your carbs as it comes in early.
I think I want to go back to something you both mentioned. It reminds me, much of intermittent fasting is predicated on your body being able to adjust itself as well. But for people who their stomach might not shrink or their body might not adjust appropriately, they can't shake off the feeling of being hungry. What tells you this is part of the natural process of your body being, you know, adjusting and you have to get used to that discomfort versus it being a warning sign that can cause acid reflux or gastric or even other problems? What advice do you have for people who are trying intermittent fasting and are dealing with these issues?
We need to understand that hunger is a natural response.
Mm-hmm.
And why is the response triggered? Because the energy levels, the fuel storage that the body perceives needs to be there are lower. The tanks are empty, right? It's like when you go now in this automated day and your fuel tank goes to about red, it starts beeping and tells you you're going to run out of petrol. So the body is giving you that signal to eat. It will take a length of time before your brain center readjusts and calibrates to the new norm that you want it to.
How much time is the normal?
It can be months to years.
Wow.
And it may never happen. So that's something that we poorly understand, but something that is very hard to recalibrate medically. And that's why people re-put back their weight and then they go back on it. So it's a continuous fight against putting weight. You keep putting up with it. You lose, you gain, you lose, you gain, you lose, gain. So where are we deficient here? We can't sustain that. You know, it would be nice. I lose 10 pounds and then I just stay there. My body says, okay, I'm happy you've lost 10 and that's listed. The body doesn't do that. The body always remembers the highest point you achieve and then tries to maintain you. And once you cheat, it says, okay, you cheated last time. I'll give you another 2 kgs on top of this.
Oh God, that's terrifying.
So, right. So that's how physiology plays itself out.
Yeah, I do find that hunger management is a very big thing, especially when it comes to weight loss, because unfortunately, if you want to lose weight, you're going to go through some periods of hunger and people struggle with that. I tend to tell my patients that there's really two types of hunger. One of it is physical hunger. The other is emotional hunger. Physical hunger is where, like what Asim said, you know, you are depleted, your stores have run out. And then that kind of hunger, you should eat something because that's going to solve your problem because you're just really hungry. But if you're having emotional hunger because you're stressed and you're just eating out of stress eating, then no amount of food is going to solve that particular hunger.
How do you differentiate?
Exactly. So I normally say in very simple terms, if you're physically hungry, you're going to get cold sweats, your hands are trembling, you're seeing spots, you're about to faint. Emotional hunger is whereby, you know, you ask yourself, what time was my last meal? If you had a proper meal 2 or 3 hours ago, then you probably are having emotional hunger, stress, or you watched something on YouTube and you saw some nice food and you just got hungry. So that's when you maybe drink some water and then just settle yourself or curb the hunger by doing something that's not food related. Go for a walk, read a book, text a friend, whatever. If after 20 minutes you're not hungry anymore, then it's probably just emotional hunger and you don't need to eat. So people need to understand their hunger, what causes the hunger, and what suppresses the hunger as well.
On the contrary, though, could intermittent fasting be unsafe? And are there segments of people who might be less suited for it? Because we know that, say, pregnant women, people who have multiple complex conditions should probably stay away from that.
Medically, there are people who are kind of difficult to manage in terms of their daily routines, like the diabetics, the poorly controlled diabetic, despite best medical therapy. They might not be really suitable for it because you need to tweak your dosing of either medications or insulin, whatever, very fast. So probably need to take a more balanced approach. Even if they want to go on intermittent fasting, then they probably can't do 20-hour circuit with 4 hours of eating. That doesn't work. You need to really do something which is more practical as far as the glucose monitoring circuit. And pregnant women, you rightly put up there, probably not the greatest. And then we talk about a category which I say the physiology is so bad that they have gotten to such an extent where even intermittent fasting is not going to help.
Who are these people?
BMI might not be the really best gauge of it, but probably the best tool we have at the moment. And I would say somebody who crosses 32, somewhere 30, 32, the further you go from what we accept as a normal BMI, then it becomes more difficult to reverse the weight regain. So the earlier you come into all these kind of diets, the better, because there's a chance you can refix your remote centers. But if you 60 BMI, it will work. It's definitely going to work. It's going to give you 10 pounds down, 20 pounds down. But will it be sustainable? The answer is probably for a very short period of time. And the likelihood you will put on more weight after you stop it is very high. We got to be realistic with our expectations.
Jacqueline, just to throw this question to you, right? Could intermittent fasting be more suited to kinds of people with certain lifestyles? I ask because, of course, if you're a social butterfly and you've got all these dinners, it's just going to be impossible to do intermittent fasting, no?
Yeah, exactly. So that's why I say it's not sustainable for the long term. It makes you quite socially awkward because if you have to meet your friends by 6 o'clock and they finish work only at that time, I think it's not practical at all. So people who try to embark on it, I'll say, have a think about it. But for your own curiosity, do it. Do it for a while and then see how you go with it. See how long you last. But try and bear in mind those healthy dietary principles. You know, it's something that I really don't recommend. It's exactly for that purpose because you can't socialize as easily as that.
I want to talk about choice and genetics when it comes to weight management. We ran a story recently about a 200kg man who had to undergo some surgery and that really helped him control his weight. But some netizens have asked if the abundance of sweet treats have led to a habit of overeating that accumulates. So the question is, how much of our weight is due to really our choices and that of our parents based on the populations and all the studies that you've seen?
These are complex interactions. They're not so simple to define. You have an individual, you have the ecosystem around him, and you have his genetics to play. Each of them plays a part in it. What proportion comes in? Is it all about genetics? No. I say in the financial world, there are two kinds of people. There are those who have a lot of money and will invest it into other projects to generate money. And there are others like me who will just put it in the bank, right? So we are the storage guys, right? There are the others who are the spenders, but they're making money out of it, right? So similarly, genetics drives thermogenesis to a certain part. Other people may eat more than I do eat, and they will never put on weight. And there are those guys who would literally eat little, but they will convert every little cent of extra energy into fat they have.
That's really annoying.
So that's genetically driven. Then environment, workspace, you know. So if at 10 friends go together out, have they, everybody's eating burger, I'm going to eat a salad. How long am I going to be able to keep it? If there's only fast food around me, there's no normal food around me, no salad bars, can I do it? How do I control my emotions and stress, and what levels do I? If I'm a watchman at night, there's no television, there's nothing, what do I do? A packet of chips is very lovely, you know, a drink of Coke is good. So all these are drivers. You can't blame just one. They all contribute, and they're all drivers of obesity in our current day and age.
Weight loss and weight gain, you know, ultimately, as boring as it sounds, it's calories in, calories out, and how the calories are divided throughout the day. But your weight is controlled. Lifestyle is about 80-90%. The remaining is genetics. So in that lifestyle, it's exercise and diet. 80% is still diet and 20% is exercise. You can't out-train a bad diet. But it also says that, you know, just because you eat sweets doesn't mean that you're going to put on weight. Because in terms of calories, you know, how much are you eating? How much are you burning? So people say, if I eat sweets, I'm going to put on weight. I'll say, but what else are you eating for the other 23 hours of the day? That will determine weight loss and weight gain. So it's really not so straightforward to say that just because my parents are bigger, that means that I'm going to be bigger too. If you have poor genetics, you just need to work harder than other people. But it doesn't mean that you're doomed to be overweight.
So what do you both make of this recent announcement by the Ministry of Health that says it's setting up a new work group to tackle health issues for ethnic groups? How significant are cultural factors when it comes to specific health and weight issues?
I come from a bariatric surgery point of view, and I can share that we wrote a paper sometime about 3 years ago. We looked at Asia in its own, and we looked at different ethnicities, and you can see, for known and unknown reasons, a difference in outcomes even based on surgery itself, which is spread across different ethnicities.
Why is that the case? What are the known factors?
Again, choices of diet that people make, the choice to exercise, not to exercise, the resources available, and cultural norms of cooking. Cultural norms of exercising, discipline as a community as a whole. In that research, we found that even the obese Japanese, once they go through surgery, they do remarkably well as compared to any other race on this world.
Wow.
Yeah, because it's just so disciplined. Their sumo wrestlers can go down to normal BMIs.
Right? No.
Yeah. But that is a culture of a society. Once they come to that discipline, they maintain that discipline, right? And then obviously the choices of food they make. So these all do play. And we must remember that Asians, we are different from our Caucasian counterparts, because for lower BMI thresholds, the existence of disease processes like diabetes, high blood pressures are much more higher.
Culturally, especially cooking methods, do vary across the different ethnic groups. And I think that has to be addressed, because you have to get onto the fundamentals and the root cause of why people in certain ethnic groups struggle to lose weight. You know, they're trying really hard, but what is causing them to fail? I think that if they're doing targeted intervention, I think that is actually a very good idea.
So just the last question to round off this podcast. I think we started off talking about intermittent fasting, and then along the way, surgery as well. Is there a tipping point where you look at somebody and you say, you maybe should start considering invasive surgery? And what advice do you have for people who might feel embarrassed that they have reached this point, but should actually consider that option?
If people want to consider bariatric surgery, it's not just, I think I need help and I'm going to do it. It's a whole process. You know, I think Asim probably embellished on that, but you have to go through, you know, seeing probably psychological assessment first. You have to see a dietitian, because it is a lot of preparation. You have to be mentally ready for what is about to happen. And of course, if someone is already considering that, they have reached a point whereby they felt really helpless and they need another kind of intervention. It is not for everybody, because not everyone can actually handle after surgery, but it's something that if your BMI is very high and sometimes you actually do need a lot of help, you shouldn't feel shy to ask for help, because your health is most important. And if you need surgery or, you know, dietary or exercise intervention to help you, why not?
So I think the Ministry of Health has a very clear stance on where it is, and I won't come from a long-winded answer, I just come from this. The clinical practice guidelines basically say 32.5 and above with modifiable comorbidities like diabetes, like high blood pressure, cholesterol. Why a combination of metabolic syndrome? Because the long-term outcomes if patient persists with this are very poor. They may develop strokes, renal failure, blindness, amputation. So these are patients that I would say that if they seek early, we've published multiple studies, and there's another one that's coming up where we have shown that the greatest benefit of bariatric surgery actually comes in people who have metabolic diseases. Now, if somebody at the age of 40 is already having knee pain and knees about to fail, and I can put off a major surgery by just putting off weight that is sustainable for 20 years, I save that person another implant in his life, because a knee implant may last about 20 years plus, and I could have saved that plan. So these are really patients who really should benefit. Then there are the very, very huge patients who've crossed like 45, 50 BMIs. They are basically, their risk of all-cause mortality from any reason is very high. They would benefit from this. Again, bariatric surgery is not an extreme measure because the outcomes it provides are much more better in terms of long-term maintenance of glucose controls and all that, and decreasing the risk of death, increasing productivity. However, it is a process. It is not a one-stop gap measure that you would see. So people, when they come to our clinics, to various clinics in within Singapore that run bariatric programs, we have them go through lifestyle modification. They want to try a medical therapy to help with their appetite. We give them that. We give them not so aggressive interventions like balloons, but then there are some that we outrightly advise that maybe this is in your best benefit. And those are the ones that I mentioned earlier.
Jacqueline, Asim, thank you very much. And so there you have it, intermittent fasting, food, and our complicated relationship with weight. This has been Heart of the Matter. This podcast was recorded with Sennheiser, and you can find previous episodes on the CNA website, app, Me Listen, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. My colleagues Crispina Robert and Erin Lowe are the women behind this podcast. And I'm Lin Su Ling, signing off again until we meet.